Capital One's tech team isn't just talking about multi-agentic AI. They already deployed one. It's called Chat Concierge, and it's simplifying car shopping. Using self-reflection and layered reasoning with live API checks, it doesn't just help buyers find a car they love. It helps schedule a test drive, get pre-approved for financing, and estimate trade-in value. Advanced, intuitive, and deployed. That's how they stack. That's technology at Capital One.
Happy Election Tuesday, and welcome back to Directly Current, the EV Politics podcast hosted by me, Max Patton. I hope you voted, and if you're listening to this and you care about the U.S. leading in electric cars, I think I have a good idea of who you voted for in the presidential race. Tonight is going to be crazy, as will possibly the days ahead, if this proves to be a tight race that hinges on a few key swing states and counting mail-in ballots. With all of that in mind, I thought there'd be no better guest for us to have on this week than someone who is a politically seasoned journalist and frequent podcast personality. It is John Heilemann, who writes for Puck News at the moment. He's written for many outlets. He's written books. He's on podcasts like the Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy, and he basically just has his finger on the pulse of this election season. He's attended rallies, he has covered a bunch of this business going on with not just the Trump and Harris campaigns, but also Elon Musk, and he's got lots of opinions. So let's talk about politics in the context of EVs in this American election cycle with John Heilemann. Bonus points, he drives a Rivian truck and he loves it, so we're going to ask him about that as well. Sit down, listen to this episode. Hopefully it brings you some enjoyment on an election Tuesday, and let us know who won, because that'd be nice to know as I'm recording this in the past. Anyhow, enjoy. John Heilemann, welcome to Directly Current.
Directly Current. I feel like I'm current and direct, feeling very good to be here. Thank you.
I think so. In your coverage areas, I hope you are. And today I want to talk to you about politics. I want to talk to you about your EV, all the things that this podcast stands for. So let's get started. What got you personally, John Heilemann, into an EV?
Well, I thought that it was about time. It's obviously the kind of wave of the future. And I'm interested in all the kind of traditional reasons that people get into EVs, which is wanting to A, do the environmentally correct and friendly thing. B, save on fuel costs. And C, I think the performance in these cars is really incredible. I was aware notionally, because you hear from people, but about the kind of performance you get and how quick these cars can be if you get the right kind. And then I went test drove my Rivian and I was like, man, this car moves. To be able to get a car that's economical, friendly to the planet, and has the kind of pickup that this thing has, it seemed like a triple trifecta win for me. I don't cover the auto industry and I'm a political reporter, but I'm also just a normal person who lives on planet Earth and in America, and realizes that the reasons to be in favor of green job of the, if you think that the world is moving increasingly in this direction for a variety of reasons, some of which have to do with innovation, some of which have to do with technology, some of which have to do with broad global concerns about global warming, the question of what the economic impact is, it doesn't strike me as being as being not concerned about American jobs or American innovation or the American economy to want to support industrial innovation that will put American automakers and other the component pieces of that, whether that's in the battery sector or in other areas, that will put them on their forward foot to be increasingly competitive in a world where that's really where the fight for the future is. So it strikes me always as insane that people think these things are at odds with each other and not. And there's been this kind of argument about, hey, are you for a sustainable environmental future, or are you for the American economy? I'm like, it seems like the most ridiculous false dichotomy to me. And I say that not as a partisan. I say that just as someone has a little bit of familiarity with the way that the innovation economy works and where we're headed. And I just literally came back from spending the last week or so in Michigan, where there's obviously, it's been massively politicized. We can talk about the ways in which it's been politicized in the presidential race, but if you talk to people in the automobile industry, all of them we're all going electric here. So it's not like there's some part of this, like, here's the industrial economy, and if you are in favor of want to drive an electric vehicle, you're somehow against American jobs. It's like the jobs of the future for the auto industry. Everyone in the auto industry will tell you the jobs of the future and all the growth is going to come out of the electric sector. So I just don't see those two things as really fighting each other. I think they're in perfect harmony.
Yeah, really well put. The false dichotomy thing, I think, is just important always to double down on. But also, it's that you have what we see is an inevitability. And when I worked as an automotive journalist in that specific space, not just in politics, not just in manufacturing, automotive executives understand the picture. They know not just where regulations are going, but where, let's just say, technological innovation is headed. And yet people will jump on, there'll be a headline about a slip in demand or potentially a threat to China that would basically somehow correlate rising EVs with a rising American dependence on China necessarily. People take those things and they jump on that to say, oh, there's another way we can go. We can maybe just slow this down a little bit. And I'm not exactly sure. Obviously, you spend much more time covering things like the election than I do. But in particular, when you have Trump say that EVs are fine, I'm for them, but we just can't promote them. We can't incentivize them. It just, to me, is this position of we can't exist in this world, that where gas engines are still going to exist, are still going to grow, and there may be these other things. And just looking at data, talking to people, that's not where things are headed.
Right.
This is just maybe just a general misinformation primer, but
yeah.
How do you cut through that kind of just stonewalling?
I think you have, there's always in these debates, there are a number of things that are true, and then there are a number of things that are, that where the there's a larger context, and then there's politicians who are trying to exploit the gap between those things, the larger context and the reality, and trying to exploit them for their own partisan purposes. I guess what I mean by that specifically here is there is no question that the transition from any kind of a technology-based transition causes economic dislocations in old line industries. The transition out of the industrial economy, so to speak, and the new economy, again, these are all kind of loose terms. The transition we're making from the industrial age to the information age has dislocations in it. People lose jobs, people have to retrain, people have to, there are sometimes painful side effects to those transitions. The industries and companies that most effectively cope with those are the ones who say, we can't fight the market, and we can't fight the onrushing of the future. When people started to get their heads around the notion that Moore's Law and the computer industry and the digital revolution was going to change every industry, whether it was the steel industry, the auto industry, the energy sector, people started to realize, okay, we're going to have to make this transition. How do we make it the most effectively? How do we make it in the quickest way we can? How can we make it in the way that has the least transition costs, and how do we cushion against those transition costs? Because those are going to be painful. We're going to have to retool these industries. What the Trump position is essentially trying to do two things. One of which is to try to exploit the fact that there are those transition costs and try to appeal to people and pretend that you can not go where the march of technology, progress, and innovation is going to take these sectors, and that we can hold on to the old economy in the face of all of this inexorable change that has to do both with technology and globalization. So there are a lot of people who want to hear that. There's always a lot of people in sectors that need to change and will have to change, whether, no matter who's in office, no matter what party's in charge, the change is coming. The change is with us already. And appealing to people's nostalgia about how, oh no, we can somehow get through this. You don't have to change. Everything can stay the same. I promise you, I'll keep your lives the way you like them and the way you, particularly the way you're, father or your grandfather liked to live that life, or what your ancestors did. That's always been an appealing rhetorical framework for certain kinds of politicians. And that's what you get from Donald Trump. There's also this cultural element to it too, right? Whereas if you're in Michigan, there's nothing that screams coastal elite more than, well, there are many things that scream coastal elite, and all of them are symbolic, but one of them is EVs, right? So if you're in this race in particular, where Donald Trump and his allies have wanted to say Kamala Harris is a San Francisco liberal, there are a variety of ways to get at that. One is by accusing her of being soft on crime. Another is to be soft on immigration. Another is to be pro-trans rights. And another is to be, oh, you're one of these electric vehicle driving San Francisco liberals. And that's part of why those ads, which have run in vast quantity in Michigan, have had some force, because it's not just that they're making this kind of nostalgia-based economic argument, promising people that they can hold on to a past that's already gone. But they're also tagging your opponent with this notion that she's an elitist who's trying to tell you, this West Coast woman is trying to tell you good Midwestern people, like how to live their lives, how to live your lives. And that's a kind of a 1-2 punch in those ads and in that argument. And it's why it's done some damage to Kamala Harris over the course of the last few months.
Yeah, I want to jump to the beginning of your answer about the point where you're going to have, you have pain sometimes, you have transitions in industries. And obviously in the US, there's been a lot of movement from that manufacturing to, I forget your exact words, the silicon era, information age. And so I think EVs as a signal, like what you were just saying, really one of the reasons they signify coastal elite is that you can get Joe Schmo in a red state behind a Rivian, and I'm sure he'll appreciate how it drives, but then you tell him how much it costs, the salary of the person who can afford it. You tell him that software engineers worked on it. It's this product of technology. In addition to manufacturing, it signals a lot of things that represent just anxieties about people like him losing their jobs. And that's perhaps why those Trump spots are working so well in Michigan. So to the extent that there is crossover to people who listen to this between Puck, between Hacks on Tap, the other work you're doing, let's just talk about Election Watch. This is unfortunately being released Tuesday morning. So that's going to be an ongoing scene. We'll between the fallout of the election, we'll see what's going on. There'll be mail-in counting to happen in the days to come. But just general election forecasting, connecting that to EVs, what are you seeing in this kind of closing sprint to the end of the race for these candidates with the messaging on EVs?
I guess I'd say that that if you start from a kind of widely held and I think accurate sense, which is we have 7 battleground states and 3 of them are in the Great Lakes area, one in the upper Midwest, and Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. All of those are places where some of the anxieties we've been talking about are and have been pretty profound, because they have had to make and are in the middle of still making this pretty, but in many cases, once it can be very profitable at the same time, transformation from this kind of insular American manufacturing economy to a more globally oriented information economy, which of course is also hybrid. It's hybrid. Then part of the thing that Biden has done with the CHIPS Act, for instance, is to try to make sure that American manufacturing continues to thrive. We have to have both. This is not like a either or situation, but those three regions, older, whiter, and more industrial than some other places in the country, these are the kinds of arguments around what the transition to a global information age economy looks like, where they have been for the last 20 years. Those have been issues that have cut in those elections. So those three states are the states that are, this is what I was saying was widely held, and I think correctly held, is that those, that winning those three states, considered, they're called like the blue wall states. Those are the states that where the election's probably going to be won or lost. It's the easiest, clearest path for Kamala Harris to get to 270 electoral votes, just barely. And they're the ways that Donald Trump won in 2016. They're the ways that Joe Biden beat Donald Trump in 2020. And I think a lot of the action in the race has gone on there. We've seen Kamala Harris in Pennsylvania and Michigan vastly more than she's been in any of the other battleground states. And that's because those races, she's held a small but pretty consistent lead in those states. They've tightened to the point where they're effectively toss-up races as we head into the election on the 5th and however long beyond that. And having just spent some time there, you can see the ways in which a vast amount of spending on paid advertising that I referred to earlier, when Donald Trump has really gone, Donald Trump and the affiliated Republican groups have gone after her. And again, that's an argument. Those arguments are both economic arguments and they're cultural arguments to make people afraid of her. Normally in presidential elections, those kinds of ads this late in a cycle don't really matter, because by the time you get to October, November of a presidential election year, both candidates are pretty firmly defined in the public's mind. And so really more than the presidential, although the campaigns spend $1 billion or more on TV ads in presidential elections, they usually, especially in the fall, don't really move the needle very much. This is a slightly different race because Harris came into the race so late and was not as well known. Kinds of ads would not have cut as much ice potentially if Joe Biden or someone who had run, who'd been running in a primary and had been through the ringer the way that a normal nominee is, had been the Democratic nominee. Instead, you've got Kamala Harris, who has been trying to introduce herself to America at the same time as she's tried to fight this general election fight. And so those ads, I don't think there's any Democrat in Michigan in particular who doesn't think that the weight of all that advertising has weighed her down in the course of the last month. And the Harris campaign has fought back in a variety of ways and tried to make some of the arguments that we've been talking about here today about how embracing this change and embracing EVs specifically is a path towards progress and prosperity, and that they have policies designed to cushion some of the harsher blows of those dislocations and the transition costs that are involved in moving the automobile sector into a more future oriented, more future forward kind of posture. They've made some headway with that, but I think that in the end, you are talking about three states, and Michigan has become, and in some people's minds, as important as Pennsylvania, which has been seen as the kind of key battleground state for the last year, last couple of years. Really, it's been in a lot of ways the most important state. Michigan is right up there now, and the battle has been really hard fought. No one knows how it's going to come out. If the polls are right, those things could be even narrower, those states, than they were in 2020. And they were pretty narrow in 2020. So no one's going to forecast, no one sensible is going to forecast what's going to happen. But if Donald Trump ends up winning those states and preventing and keeping Kamala Harris from getting elected, the mix of argumentation, both in free media and paid media, that focused on her as on some of these issues, the EV stuff being very much very central to that array of issues that they've used, as I said before, to make an economic case, but almost more importantly, to make this case that she doesn't understand your lives. You don't know her. She doesn't know you. And she's this California liberal, and you're mainstream Americans. That's what they would say. Mainstream Americans in the middle of the country, you're trying to make an honest day's pay, get an honest day's wages. Those arguments, cultural, are very powerful. And if Harris ends up losing those states narrowly, people go back and will dissect what happened over the course of the last month. And I think some of the arguments and the ads in particular will end up maybe being the things that made the difference. But like I said, it really is a coin toss in those states, if you believe all the polling, that both the public and private polling. And so we'll see. It's the place where if she's going to win, that's where she's going to win.
Yeah, it's absolutely on the margins. I don't think anyone would contest that. I think it's easy to imagine, and I'm sure we can have anyone on to talk about what a Harris administration, should she win, would look like for EVs. Probably would be somewhat a continuation of what the Biden administration has done. She's only had 90 days to define her platform. She hasn't really differentiated on the EV issue. There's more important things to do there. That said, let's get to the whole Trump-Elon story. That's fascinating, right? Because you have Trump, who's a candidate who is not, I wouldn't necessarily say antithetical to the idea of EVs, but spreads a lot of misinformation about many issues, including EVs, not particularly right. Receptive or open to that. Definitely wants to do away with incentives with a lot of government programs in place to advance that policy. Then you have Elon Musk, the CEO of the leading EV company on earth, doing a bunch of campaigning for him. So what do you make of all that?
I make of it, Trump is very, there's some ways in which Trump is an amazing combination of truth and falsehood, right? He lies more than any other major national figure in the history, in our lifetime, certainly. And yet sometimes he really is very easy to read because he really does tell the truth about certain things. He says, essentially, I don't really like EVs, but I really like Elon. And the reason that he really likes Elon is because Elon's really rich. And I think that all you can make of it is that Trump likes powerful people, and he likes powerful people who like Trump. And Musk has become not just a huge booster of Trump's, but maybe is the most important ally that he has, given his ownership of the platform formerly known as Twitter. And I think Trump likes the way in which Musk has embraced him. He likes the way in which Musk spreads misinformation on that platform that is beneficial to him. I think he sees the advantages of having Elon Musk on his side. And the fact that it conflicts with that one aspect of Elon Musk's economic life, he does a lot of things besides Tesla, but the fact that one aspect of it conflicts with things that Trump says, who knows what he actually thinks about EVs? It's hard to know what that would be. And the fact that he's, as you said, has spread a lot of misinformation, has been basically pretty negative about them in the same way he's negative about windmills. But what's that about? Who knows? The conflict is explicable in the sense that anything Trump says is always secondary to consistency is always sacrificed at the altar of self-interest. And in his case, the things that Elon does for him, he thinks are worth more than being consistent with the positions that he espouses on the stump. And I think it's a question for the ages how Elon Musk, who, if you had asked about Elon Musk 10 years ago, because of his championing of electric vehicles, because of their environmental impact, and because of the success of Tesla, would have been seen as one of the great entrepreneurial success stories, who is favorably embraced by the Democratic Party and people on the not far left, but a lot of progressives who looked at Elon Musk and thought, this is our kind of guy. Here's the guy who's one of the pioneers of electric vehicles, and he's the potential environmental impact of this kind of work is profound, and he was not then anything like he is now, which is essentially just a very far right MAGA, pro MAGA troll. There's a whole book to write about that, but it is one of the most stunning turnabouts of any person of consequence in my lifetime kind of covering politics, business, and their intersection, you would never have thought 10 years ago, even 5 or 6 years ago, you would never have thought that Elon Musk would be Donald Trump's chief cheerleader. But I think that Trump sees the advantages of hanging out with Elon Musk. And I think Elon Musk sees the advantages of potentially helping Donald Trump to become president of the United States, where there's a lot of potential side benefit for him and all of the businesses that he's involved in terms of regulation, in terms of subsidy, in terms of fights that the companies that he works on, that he's founded, might have with governments around the world. Having a really powerful president who owes you the presidency, there's a lot of CEOs who would like that. And I think Elon certainly is one of them.
Yeah. Part of me is wondering how to model this in the sense of there's the obvious tit for tat. Maybe this is an oligarchic model, right? There's certainly, like you said, a lot Elon could benefit in from being close to someone in power. But then there's also thinking about the right could make the argument that for the left, people like Bill Gates, while not outspokenly political, make lots of donations to the Democrats. And if there's a billionaire class that's in for Democrats, why not a very notable one for Republicans? Maybe this is in Musk's worldview in some way, some sort of philanthropic effort. I mean, I don't think that's a likely scenario, but how can people, like you said, there's a whole book to write about Musk's whole internal workings. So I'm not asking to psychoanalyze that, but yeah. How can we understand this relationship? What do you think is most likely in it for Elon?
Well, I don't think that those, I think that a lot of big, that the oligopolistic understanding of why really rich people get involved in, especially those who put a lot of money into politics, not just the normal amounts for rich people, but when people start putting in tens, hundreds of millions of dollars into presidential races, I think that my general view is that all of them are looking for something. The difference is, I think that the difference between, and of course, it's fine, but yes, I think that there's nothing in principle about the notion that there have always been really rich people, billionaires in our era now. Some of them contribute to Democrats, some of them contribute to Republicans. I think their motivations are very similar. They're trying to get richer. The difference is that you have in one candidate, Harris or Biden for that matter, a fundamentally normal candidate, which is to say someone who is not to say uncorruptible and not to say that they're not influenced by who their donors are in any way, but because they operate normally within the kind of normal constraints of government, the normal policy processes, they have a basic institutional respect for how things are done, you're not going to see a situation where I'm fairly confident that any kind of egregious corruption is going to be bought in a totally transactional way with any of those, with the Democratic candidate in this case. And I don't think Joe Biden, or I think if you think about Hollywood royalty, you mentioned Bill Gates. I think those people that contribute in a dramatic way to the Democratic Party, they're looking for a little bit of action on the side. They're looking for a little bit of favorable treatment for their businesses. But I don't think they have the expectation that someone's going to be like pushing a giant black bags full of cash underneath the Resolute desk to their feet. That's a slight exaggeration to what I think Elon Musk wants from Donald Trump. But I think part of the reason why very rich people are attracted to Donald Trump, despite the fact that many of them think he's an idiot, and many of them think he's borderline dangerous, is that they also recognize that the flip side of his dangerousness is that he's fundamentally lawless. And the kinds of corruption that he's prone to is much more like what we see in a lot of third world and underdeveloped countries, where the corruption is just a lot more egregious, a lot more naked, and exists outside a much more tattered kind of legal and regulatory structure. I think the impulses are the same, but the expectations of what you're likely to get out of it are really different. And I do think that Elon Musk is fundamentally relying on the notion that he will be able to have more influence, direct influence with Donald Trump, given the outsized role that he's playing. It's not just like he's writing checks, right? He's running a big part of Donald Trump's turnout operation. He's giving people, potentially illegally, giving people direct cash donations to go register to vote. These are like unheard of things that have never happened in the modern history of politics. So he's not just a guy who writes a check to a super PAC. He's up there on stage with Donald Trump at the Madison Square Garden thing. He's become one of his super surrogates and is also involved in a really important part of getting him elected that's beyond just writing him a check, but actually running an organization that's part of the key turnout portion of his operation. So I think it's a very different thing. And I don't think that there are very many, all billionaires are self-interested. All of them are not doing this for their health or for in a purely altruistic way. But the degree to which Musk has embraced Trump unexpectedly, if you listen to what he said about Trump, even a year ago, is pretty striking and pretty hard to understand the turnabout and the degree to which he's all in, really all in, without thinking that he is someone who thinks that he's going to be getting some sugar and some serious sugar down the road.
Yeah, it's like a hard turn to the oligarchy versus the soft, maybe the Hollywood elite, let's be friends kind of model. It's a little bit, I think, I agree with what you said, it's a matter of degrees. In this case, a kind of severe one. Last question here, since we're running short on time. You look at it in a model, let's say, again, where Trump wins the election. For going back to EV land, for Tesla, maybe that's a good thing, right? Because they're profitable, they're selling the most EVs. And so in an environment where, okay, harder for every other EV, but we're just fine. I got what's mine. Rivian, other startups, other kind of potential competitors, whether American or foreign, are more intervened. They have a harder time. Maybe that's the game plan. Maybe that's the gambit. I'm not sure. Is this a matter of the great irony, I feel like, of what Trump's promise is, as nationalist as it is? Maybe that's what spurs lets Chinese EVs into the U.S. Interest of national security and this anxiety specifically over these China, in a sense, taking over the market. What do you think of the EV positions between both candidates? I think both parties see this issue as a, let's stand up to China, but they're pursuing it with a very different tenor. So what do you make of that?
I think that this is a very smart, very earnest, but very smart and earnest question that has, I think, almost no application to reality, in the sense that this is the thing that people do with Trump, which is to say, what do you think he'll do? Given what he said, given what his worldview is, how do you think he'll behave going forward? And I just don't think it's applying a degree of conventional, the way we think about other politicians, to Trump. And I think that the part of the reason why people who are concerned about Trump as a threat to American democracy and the liberal, classical liberal sense, the liberal world order, is because I don't think that Trump, if Trump gets reelected, that and is operating in a wholly unconstrained way, as he is more or less suggesting he plans to do, I don't think it's predictable at all what he will plan to do, try to do, and for what reasons. I think that his general tendencies towards, again, what he has said, if you listen to his words, his inclinations towards a retribution and towards treating people who he considers enemies or critics one way, on that basis alone, not according to like some ideas about policy or some ideas about ideology, but just about, is he pissed at you? Have you said something that annoys him? I think Trump the decisions he decides to make about any given industry can be driven by that kind of whim and by that kind of caprice. I think if you think about what he's really talked about now, literally just in the last couple of days, he was asked by Joe Rogan if he would get rid of the income tax, the federal income tax. And he's like, why not? That answer is an answer that is both insane and also a kind of making up policy on that level. You're talking about the federal income tax. Why not? You're making up that policy on the fly. And it's clear you really don't mean what you're saying. Why not is an answer of someone who's basically just trying to be funny or be glib or whatever. I have no idea. Is Trump serious about this tariff policy? He has never yet even named, although he says tariffs are at the center of his economic policy, he throws out numbers like they're different all the time. He has proposed these insanely high tariffs, more modest tariffs. He doesn't talk about which industries. He says across the board tariffs. He thinks that tariffs are applied to foreign companies and countries when we have no ability to apply tariffs to foreign countries or foreign companies. The only way to make a tariff work is by applying it in the United States, because our laws don't allow us to actually apply any kind of penalties, economic penalties, to foreign companies or foreign governments. So it's like lunacy to try to like puzzle through all of that and say, what would the impact be on the auto industry? It's a really good question. If I was in the auto industry, I'd be really concerned about this, but I don't think that there's anything that he has said or done that gives me any sense of what actually he will do or try to do. And the other question, of course, is we have no idea who's going to be controlling, whether there's going to be full unitary Republican government across the House, Senate, and White House if Trump got reelected. The constraints on his ability to do a lot of the things that he at least has said he wants to do is going to be really considerably different if he has control of both legislative branches, both the whole of the legislative branch, both House of Congress, or if he has control of only one of those, Republicans only have control of one of those houses or neither, that will constrain him in a variety of ways. The one thing I don't think will constrain him or impose any rationality on a lot of these supposed policy positions is going to be adults in the room, because that's the one thing that I really fundamentally believe, having watched the way he's conducted this campaign and listened to the people around him, which is that there will be no adults in the room going forward. Like, his big takeaway from his first term was, adults in the room are a problem. Anybody who's going to stop me from doing what I want to do in any given moment is someone I don't want to have in this administration. And I think you're going to have an administration full of people who are just going to say yes, sir, to whatever he wants to do. And what he wants to do at any given moment is totally unpredictable. Whereas, again, I think if you asked about Vice President Harris, I think if you took the basic Biden approach to economics across those sectors, you'll have some relatively modest, relatively incremental changes in those policies. She's a little bit more comfortable with business and a little bit more a howling dog, a little bit more oriented towards the entrepreneurial economy than Joe Biden is, more comfortable talking to people, both in the finance sector and in the company formation and innovation business. So she'll have a slightly different gloss on what Biden did over the course of the last 4 years. But I don't think you're going to see something, if you look at what Joe Biden's approach to those sectors has been, I don't think you're going to see some dramatic departure in that, because it's very mainstream kind of Democratic Party thinking. And I imagine that's what Kamala Harris would do if she ends up winning the presidency. But man, Trump is just, it's a crapshoot, bro. I don't know what that guy's going to do. I have no idea.
It's scary to think about how close it is. I think the wolves where you are howling new polling results. So we'll have to look at that. But thank you so much for your time, John.
That's a basset hound, not a wolf. That's the crazy thing. That's a basset hound about this big.
Okay, that's yours, yeah? He's quite the howler. I love it. Thank you again so much for your time. Wanted you to talk about how cool your Rivian was, but I feel like we just ended up also confirming the worst fears of when you deal with someone who's impulsive and somewhat a Rorschach test. It's very hard to read into it, but I think that is an important message nonetheless. So
I'll just say very quickly, I'll say two things. One is Bill the Basset Hound, his name is Bill. When he hears anybody in this house ever talking, really trying to grapple with the possibility that Donald Trump will be reelected president, that is his reaction. And a more kind of overjoyed version of that sound is the sound that comes out of my mouth every time I drive my Rivian, because I gotta say, I was very optimistic about it. I thought it was going to be cool. Every time I got inside, I was very impressed by the car. And now, having had it for 6 months and driven it about 6,000 or 7,000 miles and taken some relatively long trips up and down the East Coast in it, man, I love this car. I really love it. I have driven some nice cars in my life. I think this car is great. It's fantastic. It's been a really terrific experience. Luckily I have a garage here in New York City. The garage that I park my car in, which is about a block from my apartment, has charging stations in it. I don't think I would have gotten, that's the biggest question if you live in New York, is how accessible are the charging stations and that infrastructure. But if you happen to have one in the garage where you park your car, you could just get it charged up overnight anytime you park in there. That eliminates the main barrier to entry. I wouldn't have gotten the car if I didn't have that capacity, and I luckily do. But man, I think the car is fantastic. And when they start to get their price points down and start to develop some models that are a little bit cheaper and more affordable for middle class people, I'm very optimistic about the future for Rivian. If they can bend that price curve down a little bit, this could be a pretty big company going forward, because they really have a handle on the product itself, and both in terms of how the car drives, how it looks, how it feels. You're driving around in a rolling computer, and it's a rolling computer that's really fun to drive. I'm very pro.
Yeah, absolutely. My girlfriend's very excited for the R3 coming, the possibility of them scaling. If Trump and all this stuff has you worried and you want to feel good about the country, go test drive a Rivian, go test drive a Lucid, go see what really smart American engineers are working on, because regardless, I feel like there's good stuff coming from there.
100%, bro.
Thanks again to John for his time. You can hear more from Heilemann at the In Politics podcast he does with Puck, Hacks on Tap, of course, with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy. And this night, he'll be doing election coverage with NBC, so stay tuned. I hope this podcast brings you some informative value, or at the very least, entertainment value, in what could turn out to be a very stressful day. We'll be back next week for a post-mortem on the election special with a boss. We'll be back next week with a post-mortem on the election. It'll be a special episode with the boss of this whole thing, the American EV Jobs Alliance, Mike Murphy. Ideally, we'll know who's president in 2025 by then, so we'll be able to have some more relevant conversation. Until then, stay tuned to us by subscribing anywhere you might listen to podcasts, between Spotify, Apple, YouTube, and more. Check out all the work we're doing leading up to the election and beyond at evpolitics.org. Have a good week.
Capital One's tech team isn't just talking about multi-agentic AI. They already deployed one. It's called Chat Concierge, and it's simplifying car shopping. Using self-reflection and layered reasoning with live API checks, it doesn't just help buyers find a car they love. It helps schedule a test drive, get pre-approved for financing, and estimate trade-in value. Advanced, intuitive, and deployed. That's how they stack. That's technology at Capital One.